You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 1st, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hi, dear. How are you?
And Evan Bernstein.
Oh, Jay, you're such an April fool. you're so silly.
Yep. Give me your birthday.
April 1, 2009.
I don't mean to sidetrack your question here, but who are all of these nosy people, outside influences I'm seeing around you by the moon card?
Oh, wait. One more.
Okay.
I love you.
That's for Bob.
Oh, I feel loved.
The funny thing is, you could do a perfectly fine cold reading with that soundboard, with that
I know. And charge $500 for it.
So, Evan,
yo,
what is special about today?
I mean, besides it being April Fool's Day, or I think that makes it special enough.
So tell us about April Fool's Day.
Yeah, I like April Fool's Day.
So there's this widely held belief out there in the media and other places that April Fool's Day, or the origin of April Fool's Day, came at the time of the adoption of the Gregorian calendar, and that March 25th, approximately, or someday that week, used to be the new year, or the celebration of the new year, and then they changed it to January 1st with the adaptation of the Gregorian calendar. However, it turns out that that is not exactly the case. And, you know, I believe this to be the case. I know Steve believed it to be the case. It wasn't until Rebecca did some research and looked a little further into it. And the truth behind it is that, well, there is no single point or moment in history or year even that you can point to in which April Fool's was adopted or became some kind of celebration. It could have come out of some kind of pagan ritual that predates when folks adopted the Gregorian calendar. It is mentioned in some writings or perhaps allusions to there perhaps being April Fool's or some kind of equivalent to it, depending which culture, depending which country you're talking about. There seems to be no single origin, but it came out of the time in which there are a lot of festivals going on at this time of year because it's the transition from winter into spring. And there were all kinds of festivals, depending on when you were, where you were, out of it, you know, kind of sprung around the time of April 1st. And over the years, supposedly, it just melded into the celebration of the various cultures. And that's more the truth about the origin of April Fool's. And
you want to hear my best April Fool ever?
Yeah.
I actually built this up. I built the lie up over months.
Yep.
And then on April 1st, I had Perry and some other people utterly convinced that I took a job in another state and that we were going to have to stop everything we were doing. And totally convinced. I faked a letter from another medical school and everything.
Yeah, I was one of those idiots that believed that.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was, it wasn't even funny.
Yes, it was.
It was to Steve.
Yeah, to you. But I mean, it was well executed.
It was well executed. Perry bought it hook, line, and sinker. He never never forgave me for getting him that way.
He never did. Of course not.
Well, we have a lot of news items to get to and an interview later on with Paul Murray from the Texas Citizens for Science to give us an update on the whole evolution creationism hubbub down in Texas. But first, Honda announced that they have developed a device that could enable a person to control robots with their mind.
Interesting, but little ho-hum. Like, what's new here?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Honda was a big company. Obviously, they have a big PR organization. They definitely are probably leaders on the planet in terms of developing robotics. And so they announced, they tried to make it seem like this was a really new, innovative thing that they were doing. But it actually, everything that they announced that they could do has already been done by other researchers. So what they have is a like this large helmet that you could put on that has a lot of electrodes, and it reads the electrical activity of the brain and the blood flow to the brain, and from that it can discern between four different mental states: thinking about raising your right arm, thinking about raising your left arm, thinking about running, and thinking about eating. And the robot will respond to which of the four states it thinks your mind is in. So if you think about raising your right arm, the robot will raise its right arm. But that's fairly crude. I mean, we already have researchers who were able to teach a monkey how to control a robotic arm and actually feed itself. That's a lot more sophisticated than what this guy was doing. But they said, well, but we're the first ones to do it without invasive technology, right? So they have just the helmet you wear on the outside, whereas the monkeys had to have electrodes implanted in their head. But that's been done already, too. There were other researchers who were able to teach a person, how to move the cursor on a screen with, again, just a skull cap, electrodes. It actually looked like a smaller device, actually, that they placed on the outside. It was a fairly crude implementation that they were showing, not really even as good as things that have already in existence. They also couldn't even give a live demonstration. They showed a video.
That surprised the hell out of me.
So that's a big red flag, too. If they're saying this is not ready for live, they didn't have enough faith to do a live demonstration. This is still so quirky that they have to do a very controlled video. So it was very underwhelming.
Yeah, so why is it news? That is a good point.
Well, I think it's interesting for a couple of reasons. One is the way that the press just completely regurgitated what Honda was telling them without even spending the time on Google or doing the background research to put this into some kind of perspective. Like, well, okay, all of this research has already been done. This really isn't breaking any new ground. But I think the bottom line is that Honda was just announcing to the world that they're in the game now, that they're going to be doing this research. Basically mentally interfacing with robots. And who knows, in 5 or 10 years, they may in fact be in the lead in this kind of technology, but they certainly aren't at this point in time.
Steve, you brought up a really good point in your blog that you encapsulated it nicely. I always had this vague unease about this type of research, and you know me, I'm generally extremely positive about the potential of future technology, but this one always seemed kind of like, well, I'm not sure how far we could really take this. And I liked what you said about it, in that there's a neurological buffer, you call it, between our intentions and our actions, and that you were saying that it could present a problem, because what if that buffer is lost? You know, if you don't, you know, that so that when you do it in real life, you reach this level of intention, you said, that kind of you move your arm, but somehow this that might be lost, and like every whim or stray thought or distraction could interfere with it. And that's an interesting way to put it, and I wonder how much of a problem that's going to be. I mean, how hard, I think it would be extreme, much harder than we think, to really make this an invaluable tool. I can see it actually helping us multitask, so that while we're doing certain things with our hands and maybe even our feet, we could also throw in another layer of mental control to maybe control maybe one or two other things, but actually really doing something really complicated that way. I just
like having a robot tail, Bob, or something.
No.
Maybe.
Actually, that probably would be much more doable than something really complicated. Like, say, flying in a helicopter with your mind entirely, going through all those complicated maneuvers, just using your mind. I think it's going to be much – I'm not saying it's not doable. I think it's going to be much, much harder than we think.
Yeah, so the reason why I brought that up was because a lot of the news reports talked about, like, controlling a car with your mind.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a terrible example of how this kind of technology is going to be applied in the shorter term. Again, you never know what's going to happen in the long run. And there's a couple of, I think, bad assumptions in there. One is that, let's say you could control a car with your mind. Okay,
so why
is that any better than your hands and feet? You know, that's not necessarily an improvement. I think there's this assumption that if you have direct control with your mind, that somehow is inherently better. Your control would
or
be better.
Quicker, yeah.
Yeah, but it's actually... We have direct control of our hands and feet, you know, and that control, what I was talking about, has actually evolved to be exquisitely controlled. The gain between our thoughts and our actions is something that is monitored moment to moment, and it's very, very carefully regulated with these very complicated feedback loops. So that you move exactly as much as you want to when you want to. You don't move more than you want to or less than you want to. And it would be extremely difficult to duplicate that in software, you know, with something that's reading your mental activity. And in fact, probably the best you could accomplish is to get into the point where your brain functions control of your muscles already is. So again, what would be the advantage to it all?
Right.
Trial and error in actual applications will tell us, you know, where it has its utilities. But I think the clearest utility, which I'm surprised was not mentioned in any of the articles I read, was in for people who are physically handicapped. So yeah, if you're paralyzed, this is great. You know, if you can't move your arms and legs, the ability to communicate with a computer and control robots and whatever will be obviously extremely liberating. So that really, I think, is where this is going in the short run.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's a weird thing to say, yeah, we could, you know, fly helicopters or drive cars or whatever. Like, those are things we want robots to do or want computers to do anyway. We, you know, I don't want to, you know, be able to sit back and drive my car without using my hands and feet. If I'm going to be like that, I would rather be in the back seat watching a movie or something, you know?
Yeah, Steve, I agree. Helping the handicapped, I think, would be a great application. And that, like I said, I think another early application would be augmenting able-bodied people in terms of things like helping us multitask, adding just another layer of things that we'll able to do concurrently.
Yeah. But
like
we'll see. Driving, I mean, who knows how easy or hard that will be, Bob. That's
right.
I think trial and error will tell us if that's going to even work.
One quick example, Steve. You're driving your car. You want to raise the volume of the songs, of the music that you're listening to. You can make it, you know, just think about it, to raise it instead of actually taking your hand off of the steering wheel, or I guess even saying, you know, volume up, whatever.
Yeah,
but right. That's what I'm thinking, just something that will just make it easier to perform multiple tasks, which we are notoriously bad at doing anyway.
Right, but the big problem with that, Bob, is not that we lack enough arms, is that we can't divide our attention between too many things. So imagine trying to coordinate your arms and legs to drive a car and then think in the very precise way you need to do to mentally control a machine.
Yeah, like imagine if you had a face like that guy from the Pirates of the Caribbean with all those tentacles and each one of them was like an arm. That would be awesome. Like you could do a jigsaw puzzle in like 15 seconds.
But the problem is that our brains theoretically, a creature like that, their brain would map to every tentacle. They would have the cortex to control all those tentacles. We don't. We have the cortex to control the limbs that we have. Trying to multitask beyond that could divide our attention to distraction to the point where we couldn't effectively, you know, drive the car.
But Steve, I mean, if research has shown us anything, it's how plastic the brain is and how it can adapt to encompass these other sensory modalities. Or, I mean, I've seen research where it's like the brain just like, yep, okay, I could deal with that.
Yeah, I mean that's true, but perhaps it's the kind of thing where you may have to grow up with it before you really see its full utility. Or it may take a tremendous amount of practice and learning. But again, like you said, turning up the volume with your mind, well, why not just have voice recognition where you could just say increase volume and it happens?
Yeah, I mentioned that, and it might be just a poor example, but just an example of just something to you know, extra multitasking.
Right, but that's my point, though. I'm still waiting to hear the example where it would be easier to do it by direct mental control rather than either physical or vocal or you moving your eyes or something where there's a physical interface rather than a purely mental interface. I haven't heard the example of that yet. I'm not saying it's not out there, but I think it's not going to be as intuitive or as obvious as people may think.
Well, Steve, then what about using your limbs, your voice, and your mind at the same time?
Okay. I mean, I think at one point you exceed the ability to divide your attention between many different things. But we will see. We will see, right? It's hard to predict that. And again, there'd have to be a compelling reason why it would be advantageous beyond using simpler interfaces. Anyway, let's go on to the next news item. Bob,
is Rebecca with us?
Tell us about the giant protozoans.
I'm calling this the case of the macro microbes.
This is
a pretty interesting story that you sent me, Steve. Recently, biologist Mikhail Matz and colleagues were looking for a fish that glow in the dark in the Bahamas, but instead they found a type of amoeba that may eventually rewrite some of the evolution textbooks. What they found is a species called Gromia spherica, which is a giant single-cell protozoan the size of a grape, which is, you know, pretty big for a single-celled organisms. They are actually distant relatives of microscopic amoeba, and they were discovered in the year 2000. So that's like 9 years ago. They actually discovered this thing or these things. They're a little bizarre. One thing that really stood out for me was they've actually got a shell around them. So imagine a single-celled organism with this kind of squishy, semi-soft shell around it. And I don't know why, who came up with it, but they call the shell a test, which is kind of just a blah.
That was like weird.
Very weird. Hmm. Now, the test, the shell or test in turn, is filled mostly with stercomata. Does anyone know what stercomata is?
Isn't that a vodka?
Isn't that like when you bleed from the wrists and the
stigmata. Actually, it's crap. They're like their waste accumulates in this shell. So I'd call them ugly bags of mostly crap. But as fascinating as all that is, it's not the meat of the story at all. I mean, like
ew,
I said, these were discovered 9 years ago. So what's new about this? When Matt's found his posse of protozoans recently in the Bahamas, they were all resting at the end of these grooves or tracks that were in the seafloor. And that turned out to be a very big deal because single-celled organisms aren't supposed to be able to do that. They're not supposed to be able to make these tracks. And actually, they're now relating these tracks to fossilized tracks. They call them trace fossils that are some hundreds of millions of years old. And these fossils were thought to be created by only multicellular creatures, which is related to a really important point. Now, what Matt says here is that if these guys were alive 600 million years ago and their traces got fossilized, a paleontologist who had never seen this thing would not have a shade of doubt attributing this kind of trace to the activity of a big multicellular bilaterally symmetrical animal.
Bob, what are you talking about?
What I'm saying.
Wait. We started this with these macro.
Microbes.
Amoeba. Microbes, whatever. What are the tracks? Where are they?
These tracks, they found these tracks in the seafloor of the Bahamas made by these animals, by these.
And how small are the tracks? Are they microscopic tracks?
No. Picture a grape rolling around on the floor.
So these microbes are the size of grapes?
Yes.
Yes. And they leave these tracks, and these tracks.
And they live 600 million years?
No. There are fossilized tracks. That look identical to these tracks. I mean identical, even down to the tiny little ridge in the middle of the track, bisecting it into two pieces. It looks identical to the these trace fossils that are hundreds of millions of years old. And
now how do they make the tracks? They eat the stuff.
No,
they just
roll around. They use these pseudopods. These pseudopods extend from the cytoplasm and kind of grab onto the ground and slowly move themselves around. So they're not being blown by currents or anything, because where they live, it's dead calm. There's like no current where they are. Mm-hmm. So they're making these tracks. Now, this all leads to the Cambrian explosion. I hope we all know what the Cambrian explosion is. It occurred about a half a billion years ago, where all the major body plans of animals just went crazy, and we had this incredible proliferation of different body plans.
All right, so Bob, these grape nuts things existed back then. They still exist today.
Well, Jay, here's the thing.
But here it comes, Jay. It's coming right now. Okay,
all right, I'm waiting for it.
Here's the reveal.
All right,
I'm waiting.
Your wait is over. The Cambrian explosion has been something of an anomaly, because it happened so fast, even in the vast timescales of geology and evolution, it's still relatively fast that all this happened. So when they saw
but
these
still
tracks,
we're talking about millions of years, to be clear.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But still, it's a lot's going on, even in tens of millions of years. You still have a lot. There's a lot going on. When they saw these tracks that happened that were created in the Precambrian time frame, they said, all right, here's evidence that a multicellular animal existed in the Precambrian, so it's kind of building up for the Cambrian explosion. So it made sense. The Cambrian explosion made sense because you already had some animals before the explosion.
And also, to clarify a little bit further, so the thinking was therefore that multicellular evolution was taking place for a long time before the Cambrian explosion, but none of the animals or plants had any hard parts. And then the Cambrian explosion represents when they first started fossilizing, because hard parts evolved for the first time. But there was this deeper history of multicellular life that doesn't fossilize, so we have very, very faint remnants of it in the fossil record.
And Matt's unfortunately came out with the following quote, which kind of was a little bit annoying. He said, "It wasn't a gradual development of complexity. Instead, these things suddenly seemed to burst out of a magic box." Now, this guy Matt, he seems like a nice guy. He probably made a really cool discovery here. But did he have to say magic box? I've already found a bunch of websites, for example, answersingenesis.org, where they're quoting this guy. And after this quote, they say, uh-oh, "Need we elaborate?" I mean, so I really thought he, I really hoped he would have considered, you know, what some of these people would say, because that is the perfect quote out of context, right there.
Yeah,
burst
that,
out of a magic
you
box.
Have to be totally clueless to throw that quote to the creationist jerks.
Yeah, it's too juicy.
Okay, but, so what was the big point?
So the bottom line bottom line is that you can't use these trace fossils alone as evidence that multicellular life was evolving during the Precambrian. And,
okay.
Because they might have been due to large single-celled creatures. That's the bit.
Right. So there's the assumption is probably wrong that only multicellular life could create tracks like this. And so to me, it means that the Cambrian explosion was more explosive in a sense, because it doesn't seem to be any lead up to it, and it's more special than we thought, because it's really something really unique that happened so long ago that might never happen again, and even if life continues to evolve for 10 billion years on Earth. There's just something I don't want to call it an anomaly. How would you refer to it, Steve?
It's not an anomaly. It's just there was a unique situation.
Is that what anomaly means?
It wasn't anomalous in that there was
unexplainable.
It wasn't unexplainable, or even,
right.
It wasn't. You don't have to invoke new forces or processes. It's just that it was a milestone in evolution. What you have is in the history of evolution, when one branch hits upon a completely new process.
What a good idea!
Yeah, that it opens up new vistas, there is an explosion, right? It's like the first bird, the first line of feathered dinosaurs that figured out the whole flying thing exploded, over time into all the birds that we have today. So you have, imagine you have our entire world populated with single-celled creatures, funguses and stuff, and protozoans and bacteria, and then one line of life figures out how probably existing as a colony, figured out how to divide up the labor between different cells so that you basically have the first basic multicellular creature. Well, that had such a huge advantage over the single-celled creatures in terms of just the ability to experiment with new body designs and new plants. It was on a completely different plane now that it exploded. That makes perfect sense. Just within what we know about how evolution works.
Right.
New niches opened up, new possibilities opened up. It broke through a ceiling into a completely new era of evolution. Right? But I think that's the consensus view about what the Cambrian explosion represents. To some extent, the only real question is, to what extent is the explosion that we see an artifact of fossilization, and to what extent does it represent the actual a true evolutionary explosion? And that is still unresolved, although this just takes away one piece of evidence for a longer non-fossilizing multicellular history before the Cambrian.
And it might be unresolvable, because what wasn't fossilized wasn't fossilized, and if that information is gone.
All right, I have one more question. So what you're saying, is that these microbes did not evolve in the past 10 million years.
Well, some people were calling these guys the best living fossils ever, because maybe they really haven't evolved much in many, many millions of years. So
who knows?
It's funny to think that we're getting a hint on how evolution took place and everything by something that didn't evolve much.
Well, we don't know. Right. I doubt this thing has been around for 600 million years. It probably – obviously, that also – just because even if it were a grape-sized protozoan 600 million years ago, and it still is, that doesn't mean it hasn't been evolving. It could be much different than it was back then. Again, you're thinking of evolution from a multicellular life sort of bias, where it has to actually change its shape a lot in order to be evolving. But things right. like single-celled creatures don't necessarily have to change their shape very much. Their evolution can occur largely in terms of their biochemistry and the kind of things that they do.
You'd think that it would, you know, evolve an ass and poop all that stuff out eventually, right?
Well, maybe it likes having its crap on
Too
the
complex.
Outside. It may be a good defense mechanism.
I'm just saying.
Could be. All it showed is that all you need is a big single celled organism, and you can leave these tracks. You don't need multicellular bilateral life to leave tracks like that. That's really the main.
That's the bottom line.
Bob, I'm so happy there's people like you.
The next news item is about one of our favorite celebrities, one of these people who's like famous for being famous, Jenny McCarthy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. She.
Again?
She hasn't embarrassed herself enough in the past. She decided to totally whip out the stupid this time. Time Magazine Online did a horrendous interview with her. Just terrible. I mean, Time really needs to be criticized for this interview. She has a new book out that she, quote-unquote, co-wrote with an autism specialist, Dr. Jerry Cartzenal, titled Healing and Preventing Autism. But she really says some amazing things in this.
I plucked one out, Steve, that I want to read.
All right, it's probably the one I plucked out, but go ahead.
Yeah. She says, I do believe, sadly, it's going to take some diseases coming back to realize that we need to change and develop vaccines that are safe. If the vaccine companies are not listening to us, it's their effing fault that the diseases are coming back. They're making a product that, and I think the word is sucks, but they
or,
the,
or
they
shit, I think, because that is
yeah.
shite.
Oh, it could
shite.
Be.
Yeah,
that's right.
Shite.
That's the exact quote I pulled out, Jay.
Very classy.
If you give us a safe vaccine, we'll use it. It shouldn't be polio versus autism.
Yeah, that's the money quote. I mean, that's what I was going to say. So,
thank you.
You know, vulgarity aside, very classy, Jenny, talking to Time Magazine.
You know, we already gave her a safe vaccine. If you give us a safe vaccine, it's there.
Absolutely.
It's safe.
So that's the first thing. There is a safe vaccine. You know, it's only because of your ridiculous, you know, scientific illiteracy and pseudoscience that you think it isn't safe. And yes, you know, the vaccine companies are listening to the public more. They're listening to you more than you deserve. They took thimerosal out of the vaccines in 2002, really just to quell the hysteria that the anti-vaccinationists were promoting, not because of any science.
Yeah, but now it's aluminum, Steve.
Yeah, now it's aluminum, right?
And the virus vectors themselves.
which is ridiculous. So now she's pulling what we call the toxin gambit. There are toxins in the vaccines. But you know, we've talked about this multiple times in the past. It's all made up misunderstandings of what's actually in the vaccines. That's basically what she's saying. And she's saying, it's okay. I don't care if other people's kids die or if they get really sick, you know, from diseases that could be prevented. Because I have a bunch of made-up pseudoscientific crap about vaccines, you know.
Yeah, and the thing is, the way I've been looking at her recently is that this entire thing that she's doing is to make herself feel better about her autistic kid.
Yeah.
She's basically spinning all of this BS because she is, you know, she's been upset about her son having autism. She wants to blame it on somebody. She wants to basically make somebody the bad guy for this horrible thing that affects her life, you know?
That's possible. We can't read her mind. That's, you know, some people respond that way.
And I think that was clear from the beginning when she, you know, this all started out as a crystal child, indigo child.
Yeah, that's right.
I know we've talked about her in the past, but, you know, there's never enough time to ridicule her. The new bit here is her, you know, in public saying on record now that, yes, diseases are going to come back because of what she is doing. One of our listeners started a website called Jenny McCarthy Body Count, which basically is tracking the CDC reports of the vaccine-preventable diseases that are on the rise in this country. So there is a body count.
You know, she's in Time Magazine, and she's being interviewed by the science editor. And, you know, he starts off throwing out a few good questions. Then she gives her crap answer that's riddled with misconceptions and fallacies. And there's no follow-up.
Yeah, so the science editor is Jeffrey Kluger, and I give him a total fail for this interview because of that exact point, Rebecca. He did not follow through and give the correct information. He let her just say her crap and get away with it.
Yep.
Speaking of Jenny McCarthy and autism, mm-hmm. we literally just got an email from Jaden, who was in a Barnes and Noble in Norman, Oklahoma, and noticed a display for Autism Awareness Month. And two of the books out of maybe, six or seven are The Autism and ADHD Diet, and the other is Mother Warriors by Jenny McCarthy.
That's terrible.
It's kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Come on, Barnes & Noble. If you guys go to your local Barnes & Noble and you see a similar display, just, you can pick up those books and move them around. It'll be a while before they even notice.
We're not suggesting you do any vandalism or anything, but...
Don't spray paint the book. Just move it back to its rightful place in the fiction aisle. Paul Offit's book, Autism's False Prophets. Maybe that belongs in the display.
Right, or make a very angry suggestion to the people at Barnes & Noble who honestly don't care.
Yep,
that's right.
May I help you, sir? Right.
Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Paul Murray. Paul, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Well, thank you for letting me on the show. Big howdy from deep in the heart of Texas, or as we're calling it now, New Kansas.
I don't think we're in New Kansas anymore.
So Paul is the vice president of the Texas Citizens for Science, which has been on the front lines of dealing with attempts by creationists and the intelligent design proponents to water down the teaching of evolution. We spoke about this briefly last week, but this was before all the voting happened. So Paul, why don't you bring us up to speed on what specific points were voted on in terms of the new science standards for public schools in Texas and what the results were.
The science standards are reviewed in Texas every 10 years by the State Board of Education, and they assign this task to working groups, and these are people that they nominate. They are scientists and teachers and experts and people from college and industry, and they're each assigned a different topic, biology, chemistry, physics, what have you. Those standards were written and revised over the last year and presented in November. Now, the biggest difference in those standards from the standard from the last 10 years was the language of strengths and weaknesses. There was a line in there that required students to analyze the strengths and weaknesses of scientific theories. Now, this was only ever applied to one theory, and this was, of course, the theory of evolution. So this language was taken out. In the January meeting, there was a lot of hubbub over this, and they ended up trying to reinsert it then, it didn't happen. They did end up inserting a few really bad, egregious amendments into both the biology and the earth and space science section, and that kind of led to the final showdown here, which was the final adoption of the text standards in this last meeting, this last week. What ended up happening was the strengths and weaknesses language was removed, but they ended up substituting in at the last minute another amendment which said that students were required to analyze and evaluate all sides of scientific explanations. And so it felt a little bit to us like there was a little bit of a bait and switch going on. The science experts all said, we really don't want this, but this was considered a compromise between the pro-science coalition and the anti-science coalition on the State Board of Education. And how this is really going to play out, we're not that sure. It's really going to take a couple of years before we see what happens with the textbook selection in 2 years' time. In addition to that, they stuck in a couple of really egregious amendments requiring students to analyze and evaluate the sudden appearance, stasis, and sequential nature in the fossil record, looking at scientific explanations for the complexity of the cell, analyze and evaluate evidence of simple organic compounds turning into long organic molecules having information such as DNA. And these are all sort of creationist code words. Anybody who's been familiar with this fight knows a lot of these arguments, things like common descent, things like irreducible complexity, things like information theory and misuse of thermodynamics. These are all commonly used creationist arguments against evolution that have all been debunked long, long ago. And now they're in there as specific skills in the science TEKS.
And if, as you say, these are code words. The point of this, at least the fear on our side, is that these standards will then be used so that teachers or school systems will bring in either specifically texts written by creationists or the Discovery Institute, or will introduce into their classroom previously debunked criticisms of evolution or other sciences like the Big Bang or anything basically that runs afoul of their religious beliefs.
Right. The real fear here in Texas is not so much what will happen in the classrooms, but the textbooks, because the State Board of Education, these same 15 people, will in 2 years' time select textbooks. And Texas is what we call an adoption state. And that means that textbooks that are approved by the State Board of Education are purchased by the state for the entire state of Texas. So if you're one of the 900-plus public school districts in Texas, you can get any of the textbooks on this approved list for free. As a result, Texas is one of the largest buyers of textbooks in the countries. So textbook publishers have to write books that fit the standards, and they either end up writing a Texas edition of the book, which most won't do, or they end up writing a book sort of for the lowest common denominator. So many other states' school systems are going to be affected by these science standards. And what happened with the strengths and weaknesses language was there were a number of really good books that were denied use because they didn't address any weaknesses of evolution. Now, how this is going to play out, whether or not books that don't look at all sides of scientific theories or don't specifically look at these things like complexity of the cell or, you know, complex molecules having information, how that is going to be applied is really going to be determined by who's on the board in 2 years' time.
Is there an election between now and then?
There is an election. Every 2 years, there's an election. There's 15 members on the State Board of Education right now. They serve four-year terms, and they're up at alternating times. So I believe seven are going to be up in 2010. As many of you may know, seven of the 15 currently on the State Board of Education are biblical literalist young earth creationists. And so they have fundamental problems not just with biology but with earth science and really all branches of natural science.
Right.
How many of those are up for re-election?
I believe four of them are going to be up for election in 2010, including Don McElroy and Cynthia Dunbar, who have really led the charge of the anti-science coalition.
And is there a chance of ousting them? Do you have candidates set up to compete with them?
It's going to be tough. It's a very unusual process here in Texas. The Republican Party of Texas has done a good job of funding these people. These seven, there's actually 11 Republicans on the State Board of Education, and four of them have been pretty consistent to vote for science and resisted the political pressure. But the districts in Texas are very gerrymandered so that people who are not represented by Republican interests, our votes tend to get marginalized in this process. So unless we can get somebody to run in the primaries against some of these people, it's going to be difficult. But there's already a number of candidates who are already gearing up. I know of at least two candidates that are going to run against Cynthia Dunbar in 2010, and a couple others have already started fundraising to try and, you know, make a difference and switch the balance from anti-science to pro-science on the state board.
Now, in previous years, under the strengths and weaknesses language, when that was in effect on the standards, he said that was used to deny textbooks that didn't criticize, basically, evolution, didn't say that there were weaknesses to the theory of evolution. Was that ever challenged legally? Do you think that these kind of standards could provoke any kind of constitutional challenge, or have they really successfully sidestepped that issue?
They've been pretty clever about it so far. The only way that would have presented a court case is if they used it to specifically introduce a book that had a creationist, purely religious idea in it. Like, for example, something you could directly tie back to intelligent design or creationism, like Icons of Evolution. If they had approved a book like that, then that would have brought a court case. But if they simply denied a good science book because it didn't address weaknesses, it would be very, very difficult to make that a First Amendment case.
But eventually, Texas did pick a science textbook that included discussion of the weaknesses of evolution. So what book was that? And was it just a terrible science book? Or what?
No, you know, for the most part, that debate really didn't go anywhere in 2003 in terms of denying denying books. There's a number of books that are actually on the list. The only one that I know for sure that is used, in fact, is the Miller and Levine book, Ken Miller's book. Mm-hmm. So there actually are good textbooks on this list, but it's always been a bit of a struggle. You know, we're just right teetering on that line. You know, like I said, you've got 7 of the 15. That means there's always one swing vote, always one swing vote away from just completely changing the complexion of the science standards.
Yeah, so even though they may have gotten – it's like a 1-2 punch. They set up the standards and then use them to get in the books that are favorable to their point of view. And they haven't been able to do that yet. They either maybe get some language into the standards but haven't had the right mix of people on the board when it came time to pick the textbooks.
They really haven't. There's been a concerted effort since about 2000 to start stacking the State Board of Education with people who are sympathetic to the creationist cause. They haven't been able to do it. They came close this last year in the last election cycle to try and get one of the moderate Republicans defeated, Pat Hardy, but that didn't happen. So we know what the game plan is. They're very well funded. In fact, for the most part, most of the creationists are funded by one very, very wealthy businessman out of San Antonio. And until we can get people who can match that kind of fundraising, you know, on the order of $2 or $3 million for the State Board of Education races, it's going to be hard to change that. The other thing that's kind of strange about this is that every person I talk to, conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, most people are horrified when they find out that there's 7 creationists on the State Board of Education.
Young Earth creationists, in fact. Wow.
Yeah, you know, these elections are far down on the ballot. Most people don't really understand who they're voting for when they vote for these things. And really the biggest thing we can do to change that is to make people aware of what's going on.
And that's one of the things that your group does, just to increase public awareness of, hey, you have to actually pay attention to who you're voting for the Board of Education. Do you, like, put out information on each individual person running?
We've done a little bit of that in the past. The people who have really, really put a public eye on this are Kathy Miller and the folks at the Texas Freedom Network. Texas Citizens for Science is a very small group. There's just a handful of us, and we're not very well funded. Stephen Schaffersman is the president of that. He's been fighting this battle for almost 30 years. And most of the work that we do is really trying to interface directly with the policymakers, with the people who are in these agencies, trying to find out what's going on behind the scenes and trying to influence that. The public arm of this really is Texas Freedom Network and the National Center for Science Education. Jeannie Scott and Josh Rosenau were just here this last week, and they did a great job testifying in front of the State Board of Education. Unfortunately, we didn't get the result we wanted, but it did highlight publicly some of what is going on.
Do you know how tied the teachers' hands are when and if they get the new books? Are they going to have to dramatically change the way that they conduct their classes, do you think, or can they still move forward in the same fashion that they're teaching now?
I think they can still move forward. It really depends a lot on the individual teacher. The older teachers who have more experience, who have kind of been on the front lines of this, understand, you know, what they can say and what they can't say. Some of the younger teachers who aren't maybe quite as experienced and don't really understand the intricacies of this whole evolution creation debate, you know, they're usually frightened at first. And so teacher mentoring is a really important part of this process. Having experienced teachers who understand this, who understand, you know, the reality on the ground.
So the fight isn't over is what I'm hearing from you. We may have lost this round, but really in order for them to fulfill their agenda, they need to keep a majority on the school board when the textbook selection process comes along. So there's a window of opportunity over the next election cycle to shift the balance back to pro-science individuals who are running for the school board. And then even though these clauses may be in the science standards, Texas could still get good science textbooks.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, a lot of the media reporting, you know, saying that there was sort of victory in Texas and, you know, the Discovery Institute and some of the others were claiming victory for their side, I think it's a mixed bag. I think it's really hard to say who won and who lost it at this point right now. But the future looks good. And part of the reason the future looks good is exactly because of what happened at this meeting this last week. I heard some of the most ridiculous things ever uttered by a public official in my life at this State Board of Education meeting. And all of this stuff is online for the world to hear. So you can hear Rick Augusto say, if I can't understand it, it's not science.
Whoa. Wow.
You can hear Don McElroy say, and this was great, he made this impassioned speech, and they put it up on YouTube. Actually, Josh Rosen taped it, put it up on YouTube. But right after that, he made this speech about how argument from authority is the most persuasive kind of evidence there is. Apparently, he'd never heard of the logical fallacy argument from authority.
Yeah,
right.
Oh, God.
Or then he said, you know, science isn't ruled by consensus. Well, actually, it is. It's done by consensus. My favorite was, though, when he said somebody has to stand up to these experts.
Us neophytes.
Wow.
Well, yeah, we can't have a consensus of experts dictating what we teach in science classrooms.
Yeah.
We need to base it on authority.
Absolutely. There was a gentleman there, and I can't remember his name. He was testifying from the Academy of Math and Engineering and Science at Texas. And this is an organization that has all of the Nobel laureates in Texas on it, all of the National Academy members of Science from Texas on it.
And what do they know?
And at the end of his testimony, Don McElroy said, "I read what you guys write. I just don't pay attention to it." Or, no, "I just don't agree with it." That's what he said. I just don't agree with it.
Oh, man.
Well, he has an agenda.
That's science. Yeah. Yeah.
One thing, though, is this is all extremely important, and I think that just shining the light of day on exactly what these people are trying to do and what they think and what they say is critically important. But it could also be a bit of a distraction from what is perhaps a bigger issue, which you were just alluding to, and that is that no matter what the school system says and the textbooks that states are buying, there's actually a lot of power in the hands of science teachers themselves.
Absolutely.
And just for example, there was a recent survey that was published in The New Scientist, and they showed that 48% of science school teachers said that they taught about creationism or intelligent design as a legitimate alternative to Darwinian explanations for the origins of species. 48%.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Wow.
2% did not teach evolution at all. And 16% were out and out creationists. So that, to me, is probably a bigger problem than these more public fights that are taking place. Not that they're not important, but I think that, again, the people who are actually in the classroom with the students have the most control at the end of the day.
Yeah. Those numbers sound like they're fairly in line with what you see in the average population in the United States in terms of, you know, people who accept evolution, people who don't. And I think that really speaks to the larger problem of science education as a whole in this country. The people who understand science and the people who are working scientists, those circles tend to pretty much overlap. What we saw here on display this last week is people who are policymakers trying to decide on what good science is. And when you're making policy and you're trying to compromise and you've got two different sides and you have to come together in the middle and then you agree on that, well, that doesn't work with science. When you've got science on one side and crap on the other, and you compromise in the middle, you don't get good science.
Yeah, you actually just get crap. You know?
Pretty much.
Yeah. So, Paul, tell us a little bit about some of the other projects you're working on.
Well, Texas Citizens for Science is my full-time hobby because I don't get paid for that. But during the day, I work as a research geophysicist for the Bureau of Economic Geology. And the Bureau is an organized research unit at the University of Texas. It's actually the oldest organized research unit. We're celebrating our centennial this year. And this year we decided we were going to start branching out into the world of podcasting as part of our public outreach and education program. And we've started that. It's a show. It's called Time on Earth. And you can get that on iTunes, or you can go to our website, which is podcast.beg.utexas.edu. And we're doing an episode a month. And we're looking at all these different facets of earth science. You know, part of the reason we did this is it's really, really hard to open up the newspaper and not see a story that is somehow related to earth science. Mm-hmm. You think about energy, big oil, climate change, hurricanes, flooding, natural disasters, earthquakes, storms. All of these things have a geoscience component to them. And
Paris Hilton?
Not quite.
We'll figure that one out, Bob. Keep going, Paul.
Sorry, I just had a stroke there for a minute.
Don't do that while you're on the podcast.
So What was I?
Thanks, Bob.
Totally off the rails. I'm sorry, man.
But, Paul, you were talking about all the things in the news that were earthquakes.
So part of what we're trying to do is to give scientists who work on these problems a forum that they can speak directly to the public. And so we tried to make the show, an entertaining show that we get a lot of science content in there, but it's not at a level that's so far above, the average listener that they can't follow along. And so hopefully we can teach people a little bit about earth science, and it can be educational and entertaining and maybe even inspire people to learn more about these topics.
Paul, how many episodes do you have now?
We've got three episodes right now. We're doing one a month. I'm in the middle of editing the next one, which is all about energy economics, the price of oil or the oil markets, big oil, things like that. We've done another episode on water and sustainability and water use. We've talked about carbon sequestration and carbon capture and storage. We've got a lot of other great topics planned in the future, including one I'm working on, a neat project that happened here at UT where they got the Lucy fossils from Ethiopia, and they were able to scan them with a CAT scanner to see inside these fossils for the first time.
Oh, cool. Wow.
Yeah, Lucy is a Australopithecus afarensis, so right, one of the oldest members of the hominid line. Very important, specific specimen. Yeah, I remember reading about that. What were the specific findings when they CAT scanned?
I'm waiting to talk to Richard Ketchum about that a little bit. The thing that was really amazing about it is the fact that they even let those fossils off the continent of Africa.
Yeah, you'd
think.
It was all done very hush-hush, very top secret, under extreme security.
Did they UPS them over? How do you ship something like that?
FedEx.
Armed guards.
Bubble wrap. Lots of bubble wrap.
Oh. Yeah, imagine you don't want to put it on a ship. What if it sinks? Remember, there was all those I believe it was World War II. There was all the entire trainload of fossils, of hominid fossils, mainly Java man, that were just lost. Never figured out whatever happened to them.
Well, we do have airplanes, guys. So, hey, Paul. So, how do you like your post production? You have a life yet, or you get the hang of it?
Ask my wife about that.
Yeah, wait till you start blogging, and then your life is really going to go away.
Yeah. No, it's not actually been too bad. You know, to produce a half-hour show, all told, it takes about 12 hours total post-production time, and that includes getting the RSS feed up and things like that.
Oh, don't worry. That'll whack down to about 8 hours.
It'll get quicker. Right. Well, we do an hour and 20 minutes every week.
I don't know how you guys do it. I have whole new respect for you guys doing this on a weekly basis. I'm tearing my hair out just doing one a month.
Well, we're not also saving an entire state from creationist idiocy, so...
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Come on, we're saving a whole planet, Rebecca. What are you talking
about? Is that what we're doing?
Hey, Paul, so what's the next step in Texas? Like, so is November the next time something significant is going to happen, or do we have something coming up?
There's also another interesting issue involving creationism going on here in Texas right now, and that involves the Institute for Creation Research. I'm sure you guys have heard about this.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But for those of you who don't know, the Institute for Creation Research was founded by Henry Morris. He's the guy who wrote the original book on flood geology, which is the concept that Noah's flood can explain all geology, and he's a young earth creationist. The ICR is founded on the principle that the Bible is the document of record on all matters, historical and scientific. They moved their headquarters from California to Texas a couple of years ago, and in 2007 they petitioned the Higher Education Coordinating Board for the right to grant degrees in Texas. And so far this has met with failure. The coordinating board is not going to give them the right to grant a master's degree in science education in this state because their standard of science is not what the coordinating board's standard of science is. There's a bill right now in the legislature, though, to exempt them from this process. And if this bill goes through and is passed, not only will it exempt the ICR, but it will basically allow any degree mill in the country to come here and set up shop and start granting degrees in Texas. So this is something else that we're going to have to watch real closely over the next month or so.
Before we started recording, you were telling us about another development in this regard in Texas.
Yeah, bad news comes in threes, I got to tell you.
Oh.
You know, April Fool's Day was rather an appropriate day, I guess, in some ways, for us to find out about Chris Comer's lawsuit. Chris Comer was the former director of science at the TEA, which is the Texas Education Agency, and this is the agency that actually oversees the State Board of Education. She was the director of science there for 10 years, and she was fired in 2007 because she forwarded an email that announced Barbara Forrest was giving a lecture here in town. All she did is write FYI on it and send it around to a few people. Well, the TEA has a policy of neutrality in regards to evolution and creation, and so she was forced to resign or be fired as a result of this. Last year, she filed a federal lawsuit against the TEA and its director in order to try and resolve this situation. And today, we found out that that case was dismissed.
Nice.
So the TEA actually has a policy that they have to be neutral with regard to the scientific theory of evolution.
I know it makes your head hurt, doesn't it?
A little bit.
Again, this is just some legislative malfeasance that somebody squeezed through sometime. What's the thinking behind that?
The thinking behind it is I think to just try and sidestep the issue as much as they possibly can, rather than having to have a policy on intelligent design or creationism or evolution. They just simply say, we're not going to say anything about it. It's kind of a gag order.
What kind of alternate universe are we living in? What the hell?
You know, I had a colleague come down to the State Board of Education with me this week, and she brought her high school daughter along to actually to testify in front of the board, and she didn't get that chance, but what she got was a first-class education in Pseudoscience 101, because every crank was there with every argument you've ever heard, you know, things like there's no transitional fossils, there's you know, all the stuff about information theory that you hear, you know, things that, you know, micro versus macro evolution, historical sciences versus, you know, empirical science, academic freedom. My favorite one I actually heard was somebody saying that physics and dark matter will now overturn the Copernican theory of the solar system. I still haven't figured that one out yet.
Wow.
The kooks came out of the woodwork, huh?
The kooks absolutely came out of the woodwork. And, you know, as a result of it, a lot of us who were pro-science didn't get to speak. It sort of reminded you of that old quote about it's better to be thought a fool than to open one's mouth and remove all doubt. And, right. And these people, if you've never been exposed to this kind of thing, if you've never seen these people live and in person and hear what they say, it's difficult to convey to the average reasonable person what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. It's like stepping out of the matrix the first time somebody gets exposed to something like this. And once you do, you can't really ever go back to that world that you lived in before where you thought everything was hunky-dory and fine and science worked. Mm-hmm. It's not that simple. I think a lot of times science advocates fall down because we feel like, oh, well, we've got the science on our side. Scoreboard, we're going to win. But these people, they're very well motivated. They're very well organized. They're very well funded. And a lot of what these people say just sounds reasonable to the average person who maybe doesn't really understand the underpinnings of science. And so it's an uphill battle for us in a lot of ways, but that's part of the reason why, you know, I'm doing this right now and why I work with Texas Citizens for Science and why we do the podcast and you know, why we do research and expose it to the public in the first place, because people need to know these things in order to make informed decisions about their lives.
Absolutely. And I agree with you that education is probably our best long-term tool. And things like blogs and podcasts where you say you bring scientists can explain their work directly to the public, that I think will go a long way to making this better. But that's, again, that's a very long-term solution. In the meantime, we need groups like yours, you know, on the front lines trying to minimize the damage where possible and hopefully keep things reasonably sane.
Well, we're doing our best. It's really hard for us to stay sane sometimes in the face of what we see. But when you see young people getting involved in this fight, a lot of times that makes it easy for me to forget all these other things and these losses, because ultimately that's the victory.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight, Paul, and keep up the good work down there in Texas.
Well, thanks a lot. And, Jay, I have just one word for you.
Uh-oh.
Thucydides.
Thank you.
Finally,
see,
we got
the support. I need some support.
Good night, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There is a bit of a theme this week, but I'll tell you what the theme is after we do the items.
Tricky.
Here we go. Item number one. Researchers published the results of their trial showing that treating the kidney with radio waves can significantly reduce high blood pressure. Item number two, a new study suggests that drinking very hot tea increases the risk of breast cancer in women. And item number three, American researchers are developing a system that fights mosquitoes by targeting and shooting them with lasers. Bob, go first.
You bastard. Wow, this is like the toughest one all year. Treating kidneys with radio waves, what, decreases blood pressure, you said?
Yes.
Shit, I don't know. I don't see a connection, but I don't know enough about kidney function. New study suggests that drinking very hot tea increases the risk of breast cancer.
Tea, Earl Grey hot.
I've heard of problems with a while ago, a long time ago, I read about drinking very hot tea or coffee, maybe mouth cancer in some way. I wonder if that's related. Let's see, number three.
Mouth, breast. I find them related.
You find it hard to separate those, do you, Evan?
Yeah. I don't know why. Yeah, it's just, you know.
Shooting mosquitoes with lasers. I mean, how ridiculous is that? Let's see. I think the laser one, it was just too obvious. I'm going to go with radio waves and kidneys. God damn it.
Okay, Rebecca.
I'm not even going to go through them all after that. So I'm just going to say that the only way that hot tea is going to increase your risk of breast cancer is if you're drinking it wrong. So I'm going with that one. That just seems even sillier than the others.
Okay, Jay.
Oh, bastard.
I don't know how much more of this abuse I can take, quite frankly.
That's my line, Jay.
You know you're all insulting the same family when you say that. Just a point.
Can't take this. All right, so let's go through these. Researchers published their results of their trial showing that treating the kidney with radio waves can significantly reduce high blood pressure. I'm having a hard time making a connection between having some effect on the kidneys reducing high blood pressure, unless like the kidneys could somehow slow down your blood pressure. And I'm thinking, is it like a situation where they're not functioning as well and the blood isn't moving as fast through them or that type of thing? I don't know. That seems kind of iffy to me. A second one, a new study suggests that drinking very hot tea increases the risk of breast cancer in women. I don't know. I can see what Rebecca's saying about that. I mean, how hot? First of all, like very hot, you know, what are we talking here? Like
spilling McDonald's, suing for $1 million hot.
And then we have the third one. American researchers are developing a system that fights mosquitoes by targeting and shooting them with lasers. Of course, at first, I thought this sounded ridiculous, but then I thought, wait a minute, it's American researchers. And indeed, American people would buy bug zappers that shot lasers.
Freaking laser
beams.
Oh,
like you wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, it would be pretty cool. So I can see where they're going with that one. Yes, I will agree with Rebecca. I think the hot water and breast cancer is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
The biggest problem I'm having is figuring out what the slight theme here is. I don't see what the link is between all three of these. But to get right to it, the one about very hot tea increasing the risk of breast cancer in women, I'm not buying it, and I think that one's fiction.
Okay, so you all believe that American researchers are developing a system that fights mosquitoes by targeting and shooting them with lasers.
Yes.
You all think that's true.
Yes.
Yes, I do.
God, I hope so.
And that one is science.
Okay.
Yay.
No clean sweep for Steve.
So they're developing a laser gun that could kill millions of mosquitoes.
Now, did you say a laser gun?
Yeah, laser. It's a gun because you're shooting it at something, right? The lead scientist on the project is Dr. Jordan Kerr. And in an interview for CNN, he said that the laser would be able to sweep an area and toast millions of mosquitoes in a few minutes.
Whoa.
Send that to Africa.
Wow. Use it. Absolutely. The biggest application would be fighting malaria in those parts of the world, like Africa and
How
other tropical areas. They track it by sound. And it actually
cool.
can target it by sound. And they also claim it could distinguish different types of insects, so it would not zap non-harmful insects, and they also claim it could distinguish different types of mosquitoes, and they only zap the kind that feed off of humans, only the ones that will bite humans.
So then they'll have to train bats to lie on the ground with their mouth open underneath this laser,
right? And he also mentioned that there are, he says, I haven't been able to independently verify this, but claim that there are no animals that survive exclusively on mosquitoes. So even if we completely eliminated certain species of mosquitoes from the environment, it wouldn't have any deleterious effects. I don't know if that's true or not, but it doesn't sound unreasonable. He says, like, for example, you could have, in a village that has a big mosquito problem, you can have a cordon of these devices around the village zapping mosquitoes and preventing any from getting into that area. So, nice. Interesting. It obviously doesn't take a very powerful laser to kill a mosquito. These could be extremely low-power lasers. It's really just having a system that could target, you know, that could identify, locate, and target the mosquitoes.
Yeah, now the other cool thing is that they're also going to add a sound effect every time the laser goes off. It's going to make like a pew, pew, like that type of thing.
Millions of them, yes.
That's a lot of sound effects in a minute, Jay.
Well, the version I want, Evan, is going to have, it's going to shoot a red laser beam, and it's going to make that noise. And I'll pay $25 more for that.
Are you going to have a fog machine so you can see the laser?
Yeah. That would even be cooler. Yes, indeed, I want that.
Well, let's go on to number two. A new study suggests that drinking very hot tea increases the risk of breast cancer in women, and that one is the fiction.
Oh. Aha!
That one is
aha! Wow, you really sucked ass this week, Steve.
So, that one's fake, but that is related
fake breasts.
A real news story. An Iranian study showed that steaming hot tea is linked to esophageal cancer. Which makes a little bit of sense. The scalding hot liquids burning the esophagus, increasing the risk of squamous cell carcinoma.
Well, that's what I said.
Yeah.
All right. There you go.
Although the article mentions that tobacco and alcohol are still far and away the leading risk factors linked to these types of cancers, that frequently drinking extremely hot liquids may, in fact, also be an independent risk factor.
So why would they say tea?
Rather than coffee?
Are they
hot
British?
Beverage,
yeah,
how about?
I think that's just what they studied, but I don't see any reason why it would be tea over anything else. Any other hot? Okay. It's the heat. Which means researchers published the results of their trial showing that treating the kidney with radio waves can significantly reduce high blood pressure is science. That is completely true.
Second grade science.
It's actually, you know, when I first heard of it, I was like, that makes perfect sense. Because kidneys have a very significant role in regulating the blood pressure. Which, when you think about it, it makes sense. Because what do the kidneys control? The volume of fluid in our bodies, which directly relates to blood pressure. In fact, there are lots of problems with the kidneys that can result in chronic high blood pressure. But this is something different. What they did was they used radio waves to zap the sympathetic nerve endings in the renal arteries and in the kidneys. And in people who had refractory hypertension, meaning high blood pressure that was not responding to medications. And this had the effect of reducing their blood pressure on average by about 30 points systolic, 30 millimeters of mercury, but some individual patients as much as, say, 60 millimeters of mercury, which is very significant.
There's that mercury again.
So congratulations, everyone, but Bob. Now, what's the theme? Here, extra credit. Who could tell me what the theme was this week?
Well,
zapping things with cancer.
No, but what? Zapping. I couldn't figure it out. The laser one.
It's a bit of a lateral thinking puzzle. You have to find out. You have to think of what
the letter A.
They all have in common, other than
researchers.
Nope.
Radio waves, laser waves, and breast cancer waves.
These were all science or fiction items sent in by our listeners.
Oh, okay.
The first one about high blood pressure was sent in by Tony Pittman. The second one about hot tea was sent in by Holly Peacock. And the third one about zapping mosquitoes was sent in by Scott Rhodes.
And to all of those listeners out there that sent those in,
I love you.
Evan.
G'day, mate. Who's that noisy?
Let's review last week's Who's That Noisy.
Yes. And here it is. That is a race of intergalactic beings about to destroy the Earth with their death ray.
And they were firing it up.
However, they lost the instruction book and they just couldn't figure out how to make it go. Fortunately for us. Thanks, Lady Cleo. And No. A lot of interesting guesses in email. A lot of interesting wrong guesses. But there were some folks who did figure it out, and the first one who got it right was Matt G. Who said, "It sounds like an MRI scanner." And that is exactly what that noise is.
That's right.
Cool.
Yeah, anyone who's ever had an MRI, you know, should be able to recognize that sound.
Yeah, and a couple people who actually wrote in and said that they've been around them or had them.
Yeah.
That's what they recognized it as. So well done, Matt G.
Yeah, actually, the thing that gave it away to me was the clanking noise in between, not the loud noise, but just that kind of knocking noise in between is very characteristic.
Well, I mean, Steve, you're a doctor, right? I mean,
Well, Jay, if I ever do a Jerky Boys who's that noisy, you know, you'll be the one to first get that, you know?
Well, I appreciate
it's your expertise.
Evan. Well, Evan, play us a Who's That Noisy for this
That's
week.
Right. And here it comes.
But for me, leaving science behind when I did was a very, very tough decision, but I did. As I say, you have to make up your mind at the age of about 16, and I went onto the arts side. And really, for a whole period, my interest in science kind of languished. And I want to tell you a little bit about what rekindled it.
All right.
What rekindled
it? Who is that? Who's that noisy?
Who's that?
Don't leave us hanging.
Well, no, I mean, you don't get to hear the whole thing.
All right, but we'll reveal that too next week.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
So that guy's a stuffy Brit, right?
Well,
that's a little redundant,
maybe.
But
just because he's British doesn't mean he's stuffy.
Hang on, Steve, you just insulted every stuffy Brit.
Oh, did I say that out loud? I'm sorry.
You can't do that.
We happen to have a number of good friends who are stuffy Brits.
Yes.
Jay, do you have a quote for us?
Yeah, I do, yes. This is a quote from Samuel Johnson. I believe I've quoted him before. He was an English author, 1709 to 1784. And he said, "I know not any crime so great that a man could contrive to commit as poisoning the sources of eternal truth." Samuel Johnson!
I love all his movies.
Yeah.
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, we did that joke.
Oh, wait. Where was I? I was in the other room.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Happy to be here.
Who are you thanking, Steve?
All those people out there in podcast land. And thank you, guys. I was about to say thank you, guys.
Oh, okay.
A pleasure, as always.
Always fun. Always a good time.
Yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.